Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Devin, and I'll be your host for our weekly Global Awaken call. Today, our guest speaker is none other than Ben Rivers, and someone who really embodies today's theme of storytelling and participatory theater as therapeutic experience. Let me explain how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Seema Sanghvi, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Ben Rivers. And by the top of hour, we'll roll into Q&A and circle of sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. Hi, Seema. Good morning.
Good morning, Devin. So happy to be here.
Seema, would you please introduce our guest speaker to all of our callers, and then would you lead us in dialogue with Ben, please?
Yes, I would love to. Thank you. So today's guest, Ben Rivers, uses unique forms of theater and storytelling for community building and mobilization, as well as for healing and consciousness raising in communities impacted by trauma and political violence. He is a founding member of the Freedom Theater's Freedom Bus Initiative in Jenin-occupied Palestine, which uses interactive theater to hold space, raise awareness, and build alliances through occupied Palestine and beyond. Ben is also a co-founder of the Arab School of Playback Theater in Cairo, which invites audience members to share true stories from their life, which are then performed in a short improvised enactment. He's seen firsthand how the power of storytelling can act as both a therapeutic experience and a social catalyst. Ben, thank you so much for joining us today, especially all the way from Israel.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
So how are you doing today? I know it's nearing the end of your day there in Israel.
I am well. I went out for a beautiful walk this afternoon to see some of the yellow flowers that have drawn people from all over Israel.
Oh, how lovely. So maybe to get us started, I know that you've been in the theatrical world for a number of years now and even have a master's in counseling psychology and drama therapy. What inspired you to pursue theater as a means for constructive and positive change? Like, where was that seed first planted for you?
Well, as a boy, I was terrible at sports. One year, we had a youth circus come to our school, and my teachers, who knew that I really didn't like sport very much, gave me the option of attending circus classes instead. And that really signaled a turning point in my life, because for the first time, I found myself enjoying physicality, being in my body, and working with other people to create performance. So from that point, and I was about 11 then, I continued to study circus for several years. And throughout my adolescence, it had a therapeutic effect, but probably more, I would say, an empowering effect on myself. Then years later, as a social worker, I was working in a maximum security prison. And by that point, I was a responsible adult who'd put my circus years behind me. But there in the prison, we had invited artists to come in and work with the prisoners. And it was quite a profound experience for me to listen to the music and the poetry that these prisoners were making. It really gave me insight into dimensions of their humanity, which were not so evident to me otherwise. And that really reawakened my interest in the arts. And after that, I joined a playback theatre company in Tasmania, Australia, where I was living. And from there onwards, I began to explore the use of drama and theater methods for community building and healing and conflict transformation.
Oh, wow. I love how you started out doing circus because, you know, I think a lot of us, we see the circus performance and it seems very kind of frivolous, but there's so much about the physicality of circus performance that actually unlocks a lot of emotion. So, you know, they say that a lot of emotion starts manifesting in the body first before it manifests in words. So I think that's an incredible foundation that you have. And I've had the privilege of seeing how one specific form of theater, improvisation, can be applied to different aspects of our lives, from how we work to how we interact with our friends and family. Can you share more about the specific ways you translate theater and drama into the work you do with Freedom Theater and Playback Theater? Can you tell us more about these forms of theater and how it's different from things like theater of the oppressed and street theater, which are also very powerful forms of theater?
Mm. Sure. So Playback Theater was founded in 1975 by Jonathan Fox in Hudson Valley, New York State. And Jonathan's initial vision was to create a theater where ordinary people could share stories with each other and citizen actors, meaning non-professional actors drawn from the community itself, would perform back those stories to the people who had shared them. So this vision, of course, occurred in the context of a society where people are quite alienated from each other. So in most cities in the West and beyond, we don't know our neighbors in some cases. So he really saw storytelling as a way to connect with other people in one's immediate geographic community. But since then, so in the last 40 years, Playback has spread across the world. It's now practiced in over 60 different countries, and it's used for a variety of purposes. So there are many therapists who have been drawn to Playback Theater, and they have adapted it for group work. So in that case, it's not really used as a form of public performance. But in other cases, people have used Playback Theater as a way for oppressed or marginalized groups to have their voices heard. And that's primarily how we have been using it at the Freedom Theater. So in the West Bank, there are many rural and remote communities that experience high levels of political violence from the Israeli army, from illegal settlers, and yet those communities feel that their stories are not heard or their situation has been misrepresented by the mainstream media. And for them, a method like Playback Theater is really powerful because it gives them an opportunity to share in their own words about the truth of daily life. So that can be both empowering but also therapeutic in a sense. Therapeutic because to suffer alone and unheard can be one of the worst aspects of trauma. So to have other people join you, either as audience members or actors who are embodying your story, can help to relieve that sense of isolation.
Wow, that's very powerful. It's so true. I mean, even just in everyday life, that many of us don't feel heard. And I can imagine that after going through such a traumatic experience, to not have your voice heard just heightens that sense of trauma and the negativity around that, you know, those experiences. Can you share some specific examples of how this form of theatrical storytelling has been healing for the communities you've worked with, like maybe even sharing a couple of, you know, individual stories that you've heard of, you know, individuals or communities?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I started working at the Freedom Theatre, which is a Palestinian cultural organization based in Jenin refugee camp in September 2011. That's when I started. And around that time, the Israeli army were conducting almost nightly incursions into the refugee camp. And in those nighttime raids, they were arresting and detaining many residents of the camp, including my friends and colleagues at the Freedom Theatre. And this escalation of incursions was happening under the guise of a murder investigation. The artistic director of the Freedom Theatre had been assassinated several months before. So the army was coming in and arresting people as part of this investigation, but they were not following due process. So often what would happen is someone would be detained for the night, they would be interrogated and tortured, and then released the next day without charge. They were lucky in the sense that they got released, because there are over 5,000 political prisoners in Israeli prisons at the moment. Mm. So we wanted to bring attention to what was happening. And so we held a playback theatre performance in the streets of Jenin refugee camp, and we invited people who had been detained and interrogated and tortured to come and share their stories. Part of that was to give them an opportunity to experience connection with other community members, but also as a way to raise awareness. So we invited journalists and activists to come and help broadcast these stories to a wider audience. About a month after that, we held another playback theatre performance focusing on the experience of political prisoners. And in that performance, there was a young man who belonged to the Communist Party in the West Bank. And he had been imprisoned for 3 years because of his allegiance to this party. He was not involved in any form of armed resistance, but purely because of his political activity, he had been arrested and imprisoned. And during his time in prison, he said one of his worst experiences was psychological torture. Mm. And he explained what that meant. He said, on one occasion, for example, the prison authorities, and he's telling us all this in a playback theatre performance. He's sitting on the stage talking to the conductor, and there's a group of actors listening. And he's telling us how prison authorities came to him in his prison cell, and they had a bunch of photographs, which they said were photos of his mother's funeral. They said, "We're terribly sorry, but we committed a raid on your village, and your home was destroyed, and your mother was killed." And they produced photographs of the funeral and the demolished house as evidence. Later, he discovered that these photographs had been fabricated. This was one of the ways that the authorities were trying to break his spirit. On another occasion, they put him in solitary confinement and told him that he had a serious illness that was very contagious. And whenever the prison medical staff came to visit him, they were masked, and they would inject him. And again, later he discovered that this was a fabrication. So he was telling us these stories. And he said, these events had deeply, deeply disturbed him more than any form of physical torture that he had experienced. And after his release, he said there was not a single day that went by where he didn't wake up disturbed by these memories. It was as if these experiences had saturated his whole being and really continued to overwhelm him. So after he had shared his story, the actors performed the experiences that he'd shared. The next day, I met up with him for a cup of tea, and I was asking him about what it was like to share his story and see his story enacted. And he said, well, for the first time in the 4 years since his release, he felt as if there was some distance between himself and these painful memories. He felt as if a stone had been lifted from his chest. And he said part of why he thought he was experiencing this relief is, firstly, it's somewhat of a taboo for men in his culture to speak about the suffering they experience in prison. You know, you're supposed to be manly and you can't express any vulnerability. So he took a risk by sharing that story, and it's possible that other people in the audience from his community might have rejected him. But he experienced the opposite. He said after the performance, so many people in the audience came up to him and expressed their support. And for him, that sense of connection was so important because it broke that isolation that we were talking about earlier.
Right.
The second thing is that the actors were embodying his experience. They were living inside of his story. And again, that helped to alleviate this sense of aloneness, because suddenly other people are living or getting a taste of something that you have lived through. They're helping to carry the burden, which can be quite liberating in a sense. So I've heard this kind of similar reflections again and again, this feeling of gratitude to the actors for helping to carry and lift some of this burden, and also the sense of relief that comes from having a community listen and share in your experience. And often what happens in a playback event is that after someone has shared a story, the next person to come and tell a story will share a story that's connected in some way. Yeah. So over the period of 90 minutes, which is the usual length of a performance, a network of stories emerges. So we hear not just individual narratives, but a conversation between stories, or a sort of a collective story that emerges, which again helps to break down these walls of isolation or alienation that can exist between people.
Gosh, I mean, I'm just so moved by the power of this form of theater and how the experience is both heartbreaking and heart-opening. And just this idea of being able to carry somebody's burden of their pain and suffering, you know, like this young man that you so candidly shared his story. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I guess what's coming up for me is that you must hear so many of these heartbreaking stories all the time. And I know that you've been a longtime Vipassana practitioner. You've done it for about 20 years. So what is your take on how to handle that kind of suffering? You know, what kind of practices including perhaps Vipassana, what kind of practices help keep you going and kind of keep you light as you're dealing with the heaviness of these personal stories of trauma?
Yeah. Well, I have always, over the last 20 years, I've been so grateful to have the practice of Vipassana to begin and end my day with meditation has really helped me to maintain my sense of aliveness in this type of work. So that helps. But I guess one of the things that really surprised me when I came to Palestine is that people have lived through enormous pain and suffering. They continue to live under a system of terrible brutality. But there are so many resources that are apparent inside each individual and inside the community as a whole. And these strengths and skills and values and resources emerge through the stories. So sometimes we hear a story of a painful event, like someone being tortured, for example, and the teller will also share that they have been disturbed in some way, like the man I was speaking about before. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, people will share about a disturbing event, but they're on the level of their consciousness, they're saying something else. And I can give an example. There was a small community in the southern part of the West Bank, and they live in a very remote area. There's no roads, there's no electricity, there's no running water. Many people still live in caves, as they have been for thousands of years. But to live in a cave is not very comfortable. So most people want to build a house. Mm-hmm. And one young woman came forward in a playback theater performance to tell us about a house that her family had built. And in this part of the West Bank, it's impossible for a Palestinian to get a building permit from the Israeli authorities. They simply refuse to give a permit, which means people are forced to build illegally. So her family had begun to build a house without a permit. And one day the army arrived and they told, she was home, and they told her that they were going to demolish the home there and then. And she said, well, that's impossible. You need to at least present a demolition order, a letter from the court saying you have permission to demolish our house, and they had none. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, we don't care. We're going to tear down your house anyway. And she started to shout at them. And they had entered her house without permission, and so she tried to push them back outside. She tried every way she could to protect her house. And so the soldiers pepper sprayed her. She became unconscious. And when she awoke, she found that she'd been handcuffed and blindfolded. And she was then taken to prison. And her house was destroyed while she was away. And her family had to pay a sum of money to get her release, and it was a large sum of money. So this was like one kind of tragic event after another that she was telling us. And yet, in the manner of her telling, and in the message that kind of ran through this whole story, she was saying that they haven't broken my spirit. You know, they can destroy our house. They can, you know, hurt my body, but I can, I still have a choice over how I respond mentally to these violations. And later, when I went back to the community, I was doing some interviews. There was a young man, a 15-year-old man, who told me that from all the playback theater performances he had seen, this one, and that story in particular, were the most powerful, because for him it represented how Palestinians can maintain a sense of steadfastness in the face of oppression. So for me personally, in responding to your question, when I hear these stories and I see how people are able to maintain their sense of humor, their courage, their strength, their determination, their kindness towards others in the face of so much violence, for me that has been an extraordinary life lesson. And usually I come away from these performances far from depressed. I come away uplifted in a sense by how the human spirit can respond. And of course, determined at the same time to engage in some type of real action that can help change these injustices.
Gosh, it's such a testament to humanity's ability to be resilient, you know, to hear you share these stories. And I can imagine that they're so, it's a source of a lot of healing and inspiration, both for you and for the actors, you know, that are performing these stories.
Absolutely.
And it's, I mean, so externally you're getting a lot of strength and a lot of validation for the work that you're doing. And I'm sure that's bringing a sense of inner peace. I wanted to get back to Vipassana because I'm curious as to how you even came across Vipassana, what inspired you to pursue it, and in what kind of tangible ways it's impacted your work in this form of transformational theater.
I first started meditating when I was 21, and by that stage I had already experimented with other types of meditation, and I felt most drawn to Vipassana because of its focus on the here and now, and on truth as it manifests inside of our mind and body in this moment. So that that really attracted me, and the first course I did was in Tasmania. It happened at the tail end of a period of severe depression that I was experiencing in my life. And after that first retreat, I experienced, it was as if the depression had been completely lifted from me. I came out full of energy, full of a desire to engage in some kind of service. It was a really dramatic turning point in my life. Of course, depression came back, but I had a way of responding to it, and over time, the depression became less and less, and I felt this confidence because I had this daily practice, a way of responding not only to depression but to all kinds of other overwhelming emotions that were present in my life at that time. So after that first course, I decided I wanted to become a social worker, and as I said, I worked in a prison. That was actually one of my first jobs. So I worked for 2 years in a maximum security prison, and it was a highly toxic environment. Not so much because of the prisoners, but because of the way the system operates around them. And Vipassana was a way of recharging at the end of each day, and connecting to my own internal source of strength. But it also gave me a focus in terms of the work I was doing, wanting to connect to the goodness that I knew existed inside of each of the people who were there imprisoned. So from an early point in my career, it's been extremely helpful. I think one of the other things which has inspired me about Vipassana is that Goenkaji, the main teacher in this tradition of Vipassana, would always say that it's not enough to sit and meditate. We also need to take action, and sometimes we need to take strong action with a base of compassion. And for me, that's a really important concept to keep in mind in this day and age, where as a planet, you know, we're facing so many extreme conditions, from mass militarism through to climate change, and being able to come back to a place of stillness and groundedness inside of ourselves is obviously important, but being able to work from that place to take action and collective action is absolutely essential. So for me, that's been really important for me in my work.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been able to participate myself in a couple of those Vipassana 10-day retreats, and I completely agree with you how it does allow you to be in the here and now and really be in touch with all of the senses and sensations that are happening, you know, in your body, in your mind. And I can imagine that you being in touch with those emotions within you, especially as you were going through your depression, that was able to be reflected outwards, and people were able to connect to you, those prisoners, you know, for example, or even the communities that you're working with now, because you've made that deep connection to yourself and to that moment when you yourself were low. I can imagine others were able to connect and feel comfortable around you as a therapist, and I think that's really beautiful.
I hope so. I mean, the other thing is that in any group or movement or campaign, our stuff gets activated, and all kinds of group dynamics arise, and internal politics, which can really interfere with what we're trying to achieve. And even though I've been meditating for 20 years, I still get very triggered, and I still see parts of myself arising that I feel ashamed of or are getting in the way of what I believe in. But having a practice like Vipassana helps me to reconnect at the beginning or end of a day with what, with a preferred way of being, with the parts of myself that I would prefer to lead with. And it also allows me to rein in my irritability or my anger or my ego, or before it gets out of control. So I feel, in terms of my relationships with other people, it can be helpful in that way. But in a movement, or a campaign, it can be helpful on another level. And this reminds me of a group I was working with in Bangalore called Jivika. Mm-hmm. And they are it's an organization, but they've also created a movement of bonded laborers who all belong to the Dalit community in Karnataka. And every day they begin with Vipassana meditation. And they have also integrated playback theater into their monthly meetings. So through these, and they've integrated these practices because they recognize how important it is to work on developing these pathways, these communication pathways between people inside of their movement.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's wonderful. It's I think that that's kind of the invisible work that probably continues after you've already conducted a workshop or once you've engaged with these communities. It's really amazing to hear that they're still keeping these very powerful practices intact and have kind of woven it into the fabric of their community. So that's really beautiful.
Yeah, well, in the just to set the record straight with Jivika, they've been actually practicing playback long before I came. They started in the year 2000.
Okay.
And the founder of Jivika himself is a Vipassana meditator. His name is Kiran. Mm-hmm. So it was inspiring for me to come and see how an organization had integrated it into their kind of way of being, in a sense, and to see the results of that over time.
Ah, nice. That's wonderful. So I want to get back to this the theme of storytelling. I think we've got about 10 minutes left. So you've talked previously about how the arts can ignite the full range of our senses, and it helps to promote complete engagement. So tell us more about your views of storytelling and why you think it's an essential part of the human experience, given that we're living in such a fast-paced and distracted, fragmented world where a lot of these narratives that we hear, especially coming out of these communities that have experienced trauma, they're reduced to these sound bites. And there's less and less venues for, you know, hearing a full story. So why do you think it's an essential part of the human experience, this idea of storytelling?
Well, stories have always been a way for one generation to pass on their knowledge, their skills, their wisdom to the next generation. So in that sense, stories serve a functional purpose. And the same is true in Palestine and other places where I've worked. I see that often when someone comes to share a story, there's a message inside of that story. So earlier in our conversation, I was sharing how many stories contain this message of resilience. But in other cases, a story might also communicate very concrete strategies, ways that people can face certain situations. So there's this kind of practical element to storytelling. And if you think about it, it's easier to absorb information through a story. And that's one reason why in education, let's say in medical education or the education of social workers, we often learn through case studies. Because a case study is a a story that contains an immense amount of information, which is more easily accessible, it's more easy to digest than if those same concepts were presented in a more abstract way. So this is one aspect of storytelling. The other thing is that if we look at the West Bank again, when we have people from other countries coming and hearing these stories, there's something extremely humanizing about that encounter, because otherwise we're learning only through short media reports, mm-hmm. or impersonal human rights reports. Or so when we actually meet a person and we're there in their home, in their community, listening to their story, everything becomes much, much more real, and we become much more motivated to take action on behalf of our fellow humans. But one question I ask people in these communities is, do you feel that there's anything added by seeing your story enacted? Because already many of these people have shared their story in other contexts, either to the media or to activists or diplomats. So they're not, storytelling is not something new, but mm-hmm. having their stories played back is something new. And mm-hmm. and people say, well, actually, it is very different, because when we just listen to someone tell a story in words, we're engaging primarily on a cognitive level. You know, we might feel our emotions will still become engaged. But when we see other people performing the story, we respond on a visceral level. Our bodies respond, and so the experience of listening to the story and seeing it enacted becomes much more holistic. There's a multi-sensorial imprint. Mm-hmm. It affects all of our senses, which obviously is much more powerful than just reading the story or hearing the story.
Gosh, wow. I really hope that one day all of us can at least even be a viewer of this type of playback theater that you do, Ben. It would be such a powerful experience.
Well, on that subject, every year we have a Freedom Ride. The next ride is in March 2016, and we invite people from all over the world and from other parts of Palestine to join us. We begin in Jenin at the Freedom Theatre, and we travel for 10 days through some of the communities that are most impacted by occupation and apartheid. And playback theatre is one of the activities that occur during this Freedom Ride. So if any of the listeners are interested to learn more, they can go to the Freedom Theatre's website and find the dates and other details there.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. Just the final question before we open it up to questions. What is your dream for a kinder, more compassionate, and more conscious world? I mean, you talked about how playback theater and this form of transformational theater has allowed communities, even if they've gone through immense suffering, how they've been kinder to each other as a result of sharing their stories. So what does your ultimate dream look like for a kinder, more compassionate world?
Well, I think a better world would be one where there was a more equal distribution of resources, of power, of influence. But this is very hard to achieve, where certain populations on this earth become greedily attached to a lifestyle that depends on the oppression and exploitation of others.
Mm-hmm.
So If we are working towards a more egalitarian world where there is a more fair distribution of resources, I see that one step towards that is the humanization of oppressed people, the people who are being exploited in this global system. I hope that if people that have more power and privilege can understand and appreciate the humanity of others, then maybe they would be less eager to pursue such violent and exploitative policies. But on the other hand, greed is an extremely powerful force, and we can't simply hope and pray that maybe people with power will give up some of their power. I think it's up to the masses, in a sense, the majority of people in this world, to take action of some kind to stop supporting governments and regimes that are enacting such violent, destructive policies. And really, I think when we withdraw our consent, when we truly awaken, when we really see what's happening, instead of burying our heads in the sand, then we will stop allowing this elite minority to continue in the way that they are, because really it's only possible with the with our consent. But I think really awakening on all levels is absolutely essential, and from that place of awakening we have to take action, very serious action, as soon as possible.
Thank you so much, Ben. Thank you for sharing so candidly and so openly with us. It's very, very moving discussion. And now I'm going to turn it back over to Devin to open it up to other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Seema. Let me get to our first caller.
Hello, Ben. I'm just wondering, this is Mish in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you for sharing yourself with us today, and I'm really curious, have the occupationists ever sat in on these stories? Have they ever been, has it enabled transformation? I'm really wondering about that.
Yeah, actually, in Israel, there are many groups that are also working to end occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism. And Israeli activists involved in those groups are working in solidarity with the Palestinian popular struggle movement. So sometimes Israelis have been present at some of these performances. So yes, they have had an opportunity to hear stories and see them enacted through playback.
I'm really happy to hear that. Thank you. It's encouraging.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you, Mish, for your question. If I may become greedy of a host and ask you a question, Ben. I'm fascinated, and I'm actually so inspired by the fact that you're using theater and theatrical storytelling to heal people. And it's so powerful, actually, if you are able to channel the emotions and energies like that. How do you design your theatrical experiences, like how do you create the script, for example, and how do you design that is resonating so well with your audience?
Well, in part of the magic of playback is that there is no script. So when a performance begins, we have no idea what will happen. We don't know who will tell a story. We don't know what stories will be told. So there's a reversal of the usual situation in theatre where the audience come and listen while the actors perform. In playback, it's the other way around. The actors listen because it's the audience who speaks, and essentially the stories they tell become the script. So,
wow, okay.
So someone volunteers to come up onto the stage and share a first story, and there's usually about four or five actors who are sitting at the back of the stage listening, and we also have two musicians and a conductor, a facilitator. And the facilitator helps that audience member, who we call a teller, share their story. And at the end of the story, the actors stand, and then they enter the stage and immediately improvise an enactment based on the teller's account. So although the actors have no knowledge beforehand about who will tell or what stories will be shared, they have been practicing, usually for many years, often on a weekly basis, with each other's stories, and of course by performing many, many playback performances, you become more used to the process. But the skill there is really about the actors remaining connected to the teller's experience, but also listening to each other. And that's another magical aspect of playback, is you see the creativity and the spontaneity of the actors as they strive to transform the teller's story of words into the language of theater.
Wow, wow. And so when you are doing this, I mean, obviously the emphasis would be how to use the transformative healing powers and how do you tap into that. It's such an incredibly powerful idea. I'm so, so grateful I'm on the call and listening to this myself. One more question, Ben, that comes to me is sensitizing yourself. And I read about this way back when in Stephen Covey's book about empathy. And that is when I'm putting myself in a frame of reference of another person, I am actually vulnerable because I have to feel what the other person is actually feeling and going through it. And that can be so traumatic in itself because I'm kind of letting my guard down and inviting uncertainties into it. And you mentioned that you're using meditation to, in a way, channel yourself, your way through that. If you can expand on like how you are actually dealing with emotions yourself when you are in the middle of such a traumatic circumstances. If you could expand on that, please.
Well, sometimes it happens that while an actor is listening to a story, they might experience, the actor themselves might experience a very strong emotional reaction. And this can happen especially if the actor has shared a similar experience. So maybe the teller is describing their brother being disappeared and assassinated. And that very same thing has happened to the actor. Now, if the actor hasn't processed that experience, it's possible that they will be really triggered and suddenly they're unable to listen anymore. They become wrapped up in the pain that's arising inside of themselves. So one of the ways that we prepare actors is to work with our own stories in performances.
Okay.
So that those memories and emotions are not so raw, so that we can be more present in service of the teller when those experiences come up. But
right.
Of course, it's not always, you know, there's still going to be residue or unresolved pain. So another thing we need to do as actors is to learn how to bracket our own responses and put them aside for the duration of the performance so that we can be more present and in service to the tellers. But after the performance, it's really important that we are able to reach out to our fellow actors and get the support that we need. So a playback can then be used within the company for the actors to process about anything that came up for them that might have been personally traumatic during a performance.
So, and that's a great insight right there, that when you are trying to heal and when you're trying to be out there, it's good to have support system around you where over time you heal, like from time to time you heal yourself as well. Right? And it's a very powerful insight about how bracketing actually helps while you are in middle of the situation, middle of the play. Thank you, Ben, for sharing those insights. We have one comment that came over email, and it is from Gina from California. And I'm going to read it. Thank you for sharing the story about breaking the isolation with the telling and playback of the trauma story. At 48, I remember the trauma of abuse from 5 years old. I have not been able to share the story with family for fear of rejection. In telling to counselor and trusted friend, I have been able to create distance from the trauma, yet still have a desire to tell family 2 years after remembering. I feel it would serve no purpose other than creating sadness, anger, and denial within the family. But I'm interested in trying playback in a safe, structured. I'm inspired. Thank you so much. And then there's a follow-on comment from Gina, and that is, any insight you can offer would be appreciated.
Yeah, well, I agree that it's good to choose where we do want to share. So it might be the case, as she said, that to bring that up in the family context might not be helpful. But certainly there is something powerful about sharing these painful memories in a group context. So I guess finding the right type of group is important. In the Bay Area, there is a very good playback theatre company called the Living Arts Playback Theatre Ensemble. And most of the actors are therapists, and they also work, many of them work together in a counselling centre called the Living Arts Counselling Centre. So although the playback theatre is generally performed in a public context, they bring a lot of therapeutic knowledge to their work as well. So if Gina is interested in experiencing playback, then, and if she's close to San Francisco, I encourage her to check them out.
Okay, and what is the name of that unit again? Living Art Theatre.
Living Arts Playback Theatre Ensemble.
Living Art Playback Theatre. Okay. And Gina just replied back saying thank you very much for the resource. So it's much appreciated. Thank you, Gina, and thank you, Ben. And Seema, I believe you have a question to ask as well, right?
I do. Ben, I've heard about how you've introduced cultural exchange into playback theater, and I understand that you've had a theater collaboration in the past between Israel and Palestine, and are planning a future one between India and Palestine. So can you talk more about the cultural exchange aspect and what kinds of experiences have come out of that?
Yeah, well, there's never been any formal project based on Israeli-Palestinian collaboration. But at the moment, the Freedom Theatre is working with an Indian street theatre group called Jananatya Manch. So the students from our acting school are currently in New Delhi, and they're working with Janam to develop a street theatre play which will be toured throughout India. They'll actually be there for 3 months in total. And then they'll come back to Palestine and perform that play throughout the West Bank. And Jananatya Manch will be joining the next Freedom Ride in March. And we see that cultural exchange as quite significant because, of course, India has its own history of struggling against colonialism. And also, India has a very rich tradition of cultural activism being integrated within larger social movements. So we're hoping through exchanges of this type that there can be learning between movements.
Absolutely. I'm sure there is a lot of learning and knowledge that's passed on through these types of collaborations. And I know that there is a lot of collaboration happening, you know, formal collaborations happening between Israel and Palestine. But can you talk more about how, you know, the Freedom Theater Initiative and Playback Theater, how it has sort of broken barriers between Israel and Palestine, just, you know, how it's lent itself to more solidarity between those communities?
Yeah, well, a central focus of popular struggle in Palestinian communities, is to end the occupation and to end the institutionalized racism that exists. So in a positive sense, the struggle is for civil rights and equality. And Palestinian popular struggle movements are usually extremely welcoming of any Israeli that shares a similar vision. And as I said earlier, there are, in fact, many groups within Israel that are working to dismantle racism and occupation and settler colonialism. So the Freedom Theatre, as part of the broader popular struggle movement, welcomes any Israeli that wants to participate in this movement. And in fact, one of the founders of the Freedom Theatre was himself part Israeli, Giuliano Merhamis. His mother was an Israeli Jew, and his father was a Christian Palestinian. So we have a history of working together with Israelis with this common vision.
Right, and we have more comment. It's from GOT in California, and the comment is, thank you for this innovative use of art to build community and solve problems that need attention. You may want to tell your players in Delhi to connect with Asmita Theatre Group by Arvind Gore. that has a long history of street plays for social change.
Asmita
Theater. It's ASMITA, Asmita Theater Group by Arvind Gaur, ARVIND.
All right, thank you. I'll check them out.
And we'll put this in the follow-on notes as well, so we have it available for all of us. Now, emotions, like I said, can be so powerful, Ben. And I have seen a couple of examples where before and after, like once the person goes through the transformation, there is a sea change. And I would love to hear a story or two from you while doing all these plays and doing all these healing work. Is there a story or two that stands out to you, like examples of what happened to people while listening to that, to the play, or maybe after, like a follow-on after that?
Well, much of my... I've just finished a PhD thesis about playback theatre in occupied Palestine. So I've conducted many interviews over the last couple of years. And one of my questions to people who've shared their stories is, what was your experience? How did it impact you? And often people say, and the other question I ask is, what brought you to the teller's chair? Why? What motivated you to tell your story? And many people come to share their story with a very straightforward motivation. They simply want the wider world to know the truth about what's happening.
Right.
But in many, but in many cases, people say that after telling their story, they feel this sense of relief, and that's an emotional burden that's lifted. Of course, the reality of occupation hasn't changed.
Right.
So I prefer, in fact, not to speak about healing, because after a playback theatre performance or any other therapeutic intervention, the person goes back into exactly the same situation. You know, they go back to face the threat of their land being stolen, their house being destroyed, their family members being killed. So I think of this work less as healing, but more in terms of mobilizing certain strengths and resources that help people maintain their struggle in a positive way. One thing that people say is that when you are suffering these violations on a daily level, of course there's no way really for most people to release the buildup of tension and anger. And so often this tension gets released at those closest to you, to your family members.
Right. Right.
The appropriate target is beyond your reach. and so some of the tellers that I've spoken to have said this is disturbing for them to see how this burden is resulting in aggression towards people around them, their friends, their family members. But having an avenue of healthy release, it's like, you know, releasing the pressure cooker in some way. So there's a catharsis, but that doesn't mean that people are then passive and have lost their desire to take action. No, their desire to continue the struggle towards freedom and justice remains, but the bitterness, the violence that builds up inside has been released in some way, which means that people can engage in a more clear and constructive way.
Right, and that a healthy channel to purge your emotions, and so the healing takes place, healing as in your own resourcefulness to handle the situation.
Mm.
And in the process, I find it so empowering actually that you are really not impacting your immediate relationships, because I have experienced it myself. Like, I come home stressed out from work, and I would get irritated at home with family, and it's no reason, and half an hour later I just realize and I say sorry, you know, sometimes. But it's just so human that you have to find a channel to heal, and sometimes letting it out helps. And so how empowering to learn of one more way of doing that. Jyoti has sent a couple of links, and let me read her comment as well. So she's saying that she's appreciating that we are taking her comments here. And she would like to share that Asmita Theatre Group in Delhi off the call, and there is a link, there is a Facebook link for Arvind Gaur. And what we'll do is we'll share the link to all in our follow-up email after the call.
Brilliant.
So thank you, Jyoti, for sharing all the information.
Yeah,
one
thank
last
you,
question, Ben, if I may ask, and I know I'm going to more than my share as a host here. But doing all this, Ben, working through this all, how has that impacted you over time? What is the change that you see in yourself while doing all this?
Well, one thing relates to what I mentioned earlier in terms of witnessing the power and resilience of the human spirit in the face of extreme odds. So I guess on a personal level, that's inspired me to complain less, but also to devote my time and energy in a constructive direction. So my life feels more meaningful when I'm engaged in a collective struggle of some kind, in a movement that's working towards a better world. So I suppose, you know, coming into contact with so many extraordinary people in Palestine and India and in Egypt and other parts of the Middle East, has really driven me to take further steps. So I am grateful in a way that I am part of this broader movement, especially in Palestine.
Right. So we always like to ask this, Ben, and if I may, we, all the volunteers in the service-based community, what can we do for you? What can we do that will help you in this beautiful journey that is making a big difference in lives of so many people? How can we help you?
Well, I think you've helped me already. One of the things that people ask for in the communities that I spend time with is that their stories and their situation is communicated to the wider world. So I'm always extremely grateful when I have the opportunity to speak about the situation in Palestine and share with people in other parts of the world. So I'm happy you've given me that opportunity. But on top of that, I hope that people will be encouraged to learn more, you know, to read, to watch films, documentaries, to come to Palestine if people are free to come in March next year. It's really
sure.
People-to-people human encounters that really help to make a difference. So hopefully I'll get to meet some of your callers next year.
Wow, how inspiring attitude of gratitude and way of involving all.
Ben, this is Seema. I just wanted to thank you so much for talking with us today and for the really insightful, candid conversation and really sharing from your heart. I think I can speak for everyone and say that all of us were very, very moved by the stories that you shared. And it really gave us a window into the power of storytelling and how it can be used to heal and, you know, as a means to have people's voices heard. So I'm certainly going to carry that with me, you know, after this call, and just so very grateful for all the work that you're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.